Good afternoon. I call this meeting of the Job Growth, Energy Affordability, Policy, and Finance Committee to order. Today is Tuesday, February 27th. The first order of business will be approval of the minutes dated September 25th. Representative Thiessen moves approval of the minutes dated September 25th. Is there any corrections, changes, additions, or subtractions?
Mr. Chair.
Representative O'Neill.
I believe Representative Thiessen was not here that day.
Well, but he's here to read the minutes, though. You don't know this, Representative O'Neill. He came to me and said, Pat, I just read the minutes. They look good to me. Can you allow me to make that motion? And I said, no.
Fair enough.
No, anyways.
That's your call, Chair.
Okay, so any corrections or changes or additions to the minutes? Seeing none, all those in favor, please signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Opposed, say nay. Motion prevails. The minutes are adopted. Members, one quick announcement before we move on to the agenda. We have a couple of changes in the committee. First of all, we have a new committee legislative assistant. The old committee legislative assistant, Megan Rice, was she was unfortunately arrested by customs and incarcerated. So it was that or she got promoted to committee administrator of rules. It was one of those two things. I don't remember which one it was. So, Megan, we're going to miss you. Congratulations on your promotion, and thanks for your service to the committee. But we do have a new committee legislative assistant. I'll allow her the opportunity to introduce herself. And when she's done introducing herself, she'll tell us what her, if she could be an animal, what animal it would be and why. So welcome to the committee.
Thank you. My name's Amelia Allert, and if I could be an animal, I would be a shark. And the reason why is I love the ocean, and I love swimming, and I've spent a couple summers around the ocean as well.
Wow, that's a good answer. Good answer. Well, welcome to the committee. We look forward to working with you. And we also, members, we have another member to the committee, the newest member of the Minnesota House, Representative Munson. So, Representative Munson, if you want to introduce yourself, and once again, if you could be an animal, what animal would you be and why?
Okay. Jeremy Munson, House District 23B, Southern Minnesota. Even with a heads up, I couldn't think of a good animal, but off of her response, I would say a dolphin because they're really cool and intelligent, and I love the ocean too, so it's a good one.
Very good. And you should know that this is tradition, and we're very much about tradition here. Your first time you present a bill to the committee, you will be required to bring treats, and that's something that's very serious. And
okay.
Representative Thiessen can provide some institutional knowledge for you. So, what about him? Oh, Representative Neuberger, you want to say something?
No, Mr. Chair, I was just going to say the sharks eat dolphins, but that's not pertinent.
Okay. All right, so members, today, with that, we're going to be reviewing some of the provisions that were in last year's omnibus bill. So I do not see. So we'll start off with Nick Erickson. Nick, are you here? We'll start off with you and have you run through some of the trends related to housing. Welcome to the committee, Representative Scott.
This testifier looks really familiar.
Yeah.
He looks like somebody we know, I think.
I made it about 2 feet into the Capitol before, or but to the SOB before you mistake it for my identical twin brother. It's happened 3 times on the way down to the hearing room, so I am not Tom Erickson, who works for the majority staff, which comes up a lot here.
Well, Tom, thanks for being here. We appreciate it. So welcome to the committee. Please state your name and proceed with your testimony.
My name is Nick Erickson. I'm Regulatory Affairs Manager for Housing First Minnesota, which is a 1,200-member firm association made up of home builders, remodelers, land developers, suppliers, and subcontractors who are all dedicated to building safe and durable homes at prices families can afford in the communities where Minnesota families want to live. I want to begin today by thanking the committee to give me the opportunity to discuss the immediate and positive effect that House File 792, a critical piece of housing affordability legislation, has had on our state's housing market. House File 792, if you recall, directed the Department of Labor and Industry to enter into expedited rulemaking to conform the state's residential building code to the BATS-EV DLI court decision, which removed sprinklers in single-family and two-family homes. Once the rulemaking from this bill went into effect on June 4th, 2017, the cost of building a new twin home with municipal water service in Minnesota fell by between $6,500 and $10,000, with those using well service, not municipal water, saw up to $14,000 in savings. The housing industry's opposition to the sprinkler mandate was due that with the various components of our building and fire codes that sprinklers were unnecessary. Homes built today are the safest in our history, and based off research data provided by the state fire marshal, there have been zero fatalities and unintentional fires in one in two families' homes built since 2003. The sprinkler mandate added between 3 to 8% to the cost of twin homes in Minnesota. These added costs came at the same time where other regulatory changes from the state added roughly an additional $15,000 to $20,000 on homes built. With the average cost of $225,000, twin homes are a vital component to the diversity of our housing supply and also highly sensitive to regulatory cost pressures. Twin homes are a popular choice for organizations undertaking workforce or affordable housing projects, first-time homebuyers, and empty nesters looking to downsize. With the increased construction costs depressed in the twin home market, additional pressure was placed on our already stressed existing home market, further raising prices on existing homes. The city of Moorhead became the prime example of why this legislation was needed. In 2014-15, Moorhead had built 48 twin home units. 46 of those in 2015 were before the mandate went in place in January, and two in the entire year after the mandate went in place. In 2016, the city permitted only four twin homes, and only half of those were actually built. In the first half of 2017, there was no twin home activity in the city of Moorhead. And it's not based on consumer preferences. At the same time, Fargo and West Fargo in 2015 built a combined 269 twin home units and another 116 units in 2016. Since the rulemaking resulting from this bill went into effect on June 4th, twin home construction is nearing 2014 levels, with an estimated three-quarters of all new twin home projects in our state coming after the bill was passed in May. In Moorhead, where twin home construction had all but disappeared, eight units were permitted in the final half of the year, a 400% increase over the previous 2 years. Consumers in the early stages of building new twin homes when this legislation went into effect were given a choice to include sprinklers in their plan designs or remove them. And every builder we spoke with at Housing First has said that not a single homeowner chose to retain the sprinklers. And the reason is simple. New homes built today in Minnesota are the safest, most durable, and efficient in the history of our state.
Mr. Erickson, you rattled through some statistics there. Can you just rewind it a little bit? So when the rulemaking went into effect, when was that, and what
was the result? The rulemaking went into effect on June 4th, 2017.
And then what were the construction numbers that you saw for not only the Moorhead area?
Moorhead, they had eight units added, and all of those were added in the second half of 2017.
And then what was the statewide number?
We don't have the accurate statewide numbers yet. It's the census who provides those doesn't accurately give us the statewide for twin homes, unfortunately.
Okay, please continue. My apologies.
Okay. The sprinkler mandate is just one of dozens of housing regulations that are impeding Minnesotans' ability to own homes. In the past 5 years, costs associated with local, regional, and state housing regulations have increased 30% and now account for up to 30% of a home's price, depending on local and regional regulations. House File 792 illustrates that by addressing the regulatory costs associated with home ownership, the legislature can have a positive and immediate effect on Minnesota's housing market and the greater issue of housing affordability. I want to thank you for the opportunity to address you today and for your interest in the greater issue of housing affordability. And with that, I can take any questions.
Thank you. Are there any questions from members of the committee? Thank you very much, Mr. Erickson. Okay. Next, we're going to review the small cell installation reform private investment section. Representative O'Neill, I know you were the chief author of this bill last session. Is there anything you wanted to say about before we took public testimony on this?
Well, Mr. Chair, I'm actually really looking forward to the public testimony, and we've got AT&T here, but I think it's important to know that it was a benefit to not just AT&T and the Minneapolis and St. Paul, but all of the cell providers will benefit from this, and all the people that have the services will benefit from that. And hopefully he'll say how exciting it is to know that Minneapolis is on the forefront of technology and this particular technology, and nothing but good. So I'm really excited for this and glad that he's here to tell us the story.
Welcome to the committee. Please state your name for the record and proceed with your testimony.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman and members of the committee. My name is Paul Wirtz, and I'm the state president for AT&T Minnesota. I really appreciate the opportunity to talk about an important piece of public policy that was enacted last year that truly is beneficial to AT&T and the other wireless industry carriers, but more importantly for our customers and those that use wireless devices and the Internet in the Minneapolis Twin Cities area, and then as we've laid the groundwork for 5G evolution, 5G for the state of Minnesota. We started right after the governor's signature on the bill by announcing our accelerated investment for small cell deployment. Part of that was to get ready for, I had to call it the big game during that time frame, but I'm just going to call it the Super Bowl now, getting ready for the Super Bowl. AT&T spends more than $100 million in Minnesota's economy. In fact, AT&T as a company will now be, for the fifth year in a row, the Progress Policy Institute's number one investor in America's economy. I think we're projected to come in around $25 billion this year, and we're very proud of the investment we make in Minnesota. So part of that was to get ready for the Super Bowl, and we knew that there was going to be significant demand because we've done this before. We were very proud in November to announce that Minneapolis-St. Paul was one of three markets where we launched 5G Evolution. 5G Evolution is kind of the next evolutionary step towards ultimately 5G technology, which is very much in its infancy. But deployment of small cells is an essential part of that network that makes that possible. We did that in November and very proud that Minneapolis-St. Paul was on that market and we could get that investment going for the Super Bowl. Our investment in the Super Bowl totaled more than $40 million. This is $40 million of permanent investment in Minneapolis-St. Paul and the surrounding communities. We deployed more than 100 small cell sites in Minneapolis and St. Paul. I would like to tell the committee that all of those permits in that process were done within 90 days. So kudos to the local governments that we worked with in that process under a very tight time frame. A lot of, I mean, our work with them and the cities, they had a lot coming at them just getting ready for this event, and we worked through a lot of those permits, back and forth, communication in the offices, but they got done on a timely basis, and it really helped make the process possible for the big game. And we know that that was essential because, just to give you a couple factoids, if you will, from the Super Bowl, just from the week of the Super Bowl, from January 27th to February 4th, and Chairman, you probably know these kind of things better than even I do, 50 terabytes of data, this is just our network, was consumed during that time period. Now, that is the equivalent, from what everyone tells me, of 15,000 hours of the Super Bowl halftime show on a repeat, on a loop. So that's a lot of Justin Timberlake over a one-week period. For the Super Bowl game itself, there was over seven terabytes of data. That's the equivalent of more than 20 million selfies. So just tremendous demand. That was just on our network and what we saw in terms of usage. And you can only imagine, you know, kind of playing that out over the other three networks as well. Part of our deployment, as I mentioned, was the small cells. We increased our LTE capacity by over 200% since the beginning of the NFL season in the fall. We added over 800 antennas in U.S. Bank Stadium. It was the equivalent, that stadium, to cover a data usage for 400,000 people, roughly the equivalency of the city of Minneapolis in any one period. It, you know, it's the most watched venue in the world at that particular time. And we added 16 what's called distributed antenna systems in and around the Twin Cities area. And all these venues, whether it was the Army, the Super Bowl experience, the hotels, as well as the what we call cell on wheels, that had to be deployed in and around the hotels, the Mall of America, other places, uptown, to just provide that extra coverage. There was even something I saw in the terminology for a super cow. Now, I don't, you know, I thought a cow was a cow, but there's even something called a super cow, and that is obviously in some even larger congestion areas that we needed to handle that traffic. So basically, it worked, and I think what we're excited about is it helps pave the way for getting 5G, as I mentioned, 5G Evolution was announced in November. This really sets Minnesota up for getting increased investment. For our plans in 2018, we plan to deploy more than 200 more small cells, not just in the Twin Cities, but moving beyond the Twin Cities into Duluth, into rural communities as well. you know, basically this policy gives us the ability that the more we can build and the faster we can build, the more we're going to be able to get from a capital expenditure standpoint, and we're very excited about that. In your package is kind of a one-pager on our Super Bowl investment. The other one is just kind of where we invested in Minnesota in 2017, the number of communities, whether it might be a cell tower upgrade, capacity upgrade, small cells, et cetera, and we plan to continue that in the future. The other part of this that I think will be essential, particularly as we move into the public safety space, AT&T was honored to be selected as the builder of the nation's public safety network known as FirstNet. And we were very honored by Governor Dayton's decision to opt in on behalf of all of Minnesota so that AT&T will be building a world-class public safety network here in Minnesota for all public safety officials. And for us, that's a commitment of 23 new towers in and around the state over a five-year period. So a little bit on the FirstNet side, Mr. Chairman, but be happy to answer any questions about the small cell experience.
Sure. Quick question for you. Is there a very visible small cell tower that's already up and running that people could see, that if they're a well-trafficked road, people could look at to actually see?
Thank you, Chairman. Yes, in fact, we could share some pictures. We had some as part of our 5G Evolution launch. It was a beautiful sunny day. I think it was in October where they were putting some of these in downtown. So we have pictures of that we could send you.
Okay. Why don't you send it to the committee staff? We'll share it with everybody just because I notice them, but I don't know.
Sure.
Other people do. So other questions from the committee? Representative Thiessen.
Thank you. What was that called, FirstNet?
FirstNet, yes.
And that's a contract with the federal government? Mr. Chair, can I just ask a few questions?
Yeah, go ahead.
Okay. And that's a contract with the federal government?
Chairman, Representative Thiessen, that's correct.
How much are they paying you for that?
Approximately $6 billion.
So when we're going to say you're making this investment, that's actually the federal government paying you to make that investment.
Well, we're getting spectrum, we're getting some revenue from that, but the cost that we're going to be doing to that is far more than just the $6 million monetary. Yeah.
And thank you. How much gross revenues do you make off Minnesotans every year?
Mr. Wirtz.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Thiessen, I don't have those figures.
I assume Minnesota's profitable for you. You actually make money off Minnesota, so when you say you make these investments, that's actually being returned to you by Minnesotans plus.
Mr. Wirtz.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Thiessen, we're a for-profit company, and we do. This is a very good market for us.
Representative Thiessen.
Thank you. And what's your position on going to be on the net neutrality bills coming through the legislature?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Thiessen, we support the FCC's order rescinding the 2015 net neutrality order. We actually support a free and open Internet. I think it was about a month ago our chairman very publicly stated in the Wall Street Journal, New York Times, Washington Post, that we believe now is the time for an Internet Bill of Rights, a consumer Bill of Rights, for Congress to address this issue once and for all. The Telecom Act, the last time Congress took a look at telecom was 1996. We supported the Internet principles that are outlined by Chairman Powell in 2005. We supported the Open Internet Order of 2010. We took exception to the order of 2015, which reclassified broadband as a common carrier status and really harkened us back to the Communications Act of 1934. So we find ourselves here with this debate going on in Washington and in the states as well. But we really think it's time for Congress to try to put some regulatory certainty around what I believe and what our company believes is interstate issues and not getting into state-specific regulatory patchwork of regulations.
Representative Thiessen?
Thank you. And what's your timeline on passing that in this Congress that so works so well?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Thiessen, all we can do is kind of urge Congress to do that. Just to back up, the order has not gone into effect yet. The order has been published by the Federal Register. It may not be totally accurate, but I believe there is 60 days that it's posted, and then it becomes law. We already know that there's a lawsuit challenging that. I understand the Minnesota Attorney General is party to that lawsuit. Congress, the United States Senate, could be the first body that, by a vote of, I think, 60-plus votes, could actually ask for a legislative review of that order. I don't know if they have the 60 vote check. We don't believe they will have those. And even if they did, it would still go to the House And I don't think that that review would go any further. But, you know, there's nothing to stop the Congress from taking this up now and trying to create a legislative framework for the future.
And one more question, Mr. Chair. Thank you. And so is the, when you say you're interested in a Bill of Rights, is there something that's written down that says what that Bill of Rights would look like?
Mr. Chair, that you're supporting? We've not put anything in writing about, legislative principles. This is more really just urging Congress to, I think, strike a balance with the consumers' needs, but also I think going back to the approach that the Clinton administration took in 1996, which was a light regulatory approach. We all know how things exploded in the Internet from that point on. I mean, over 10 years ago, we barely had an iPhone, and look where we're at now. We're going to be talking about devices that are 5G-enabled just in the next couple of years. So I think there needs to be a balance between the two, and I think the Congress is the right place to do that.
Thank you. And it has exploded, although I have to say my AT&T plan on this, the last 3 days of every month, my service slows down very significantly.
Well, Mr. Wertz, do you want to respond to that or not?
Mr. Chairman, we've been very public about our statements on what is referred to as net neutrality, so I think I'll leave it at that.
So with regards to the 5G towers and installations, do you have an estimated time frame? I know right now you're in a transition phase. You call it the 5G evolution. When will we actually see, how far away from are we from seeing actually 5G being deployed and people being able to use it on tablets and mobile devices?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Just a couple days ago, I think we outlined the first three cities that we're going to be deploying, hopefully by year's end, Dallas, Waco, and Atlanta for 5G. There's a great deal of attention on 5G just this week between the Olympics and then the Mobile World Congress in Barcelona, Spain. We're in a race. I think this puts us, Minnesota, Minneapolis, Twin Cities, Minnesota, to be well positioned. Like I stated before, the 5G evolution is a great underpinning with the small cell deployment because that is the essential part of that. And we're going to be deploying thousands of these nationwide to get the network ready for 5G. So I think, very quickly, once we see these cities, I don't want to be market rendered by putting a date on anything, but hopefully we're coming back to you within a year talking about future plans.
And do you have a, I want to quiz you on the technology of it, but 5G, there's published results of what potential download speeds could be and what 4G and 3G are. Do you happen to know those numbers? And
Mr. Chairman, from what I've we're testing this right now in kind of Austin, Texas, in laboratory settings. We're seeing 14 gigabit type speeds. We also have in Minneapolis, this is where the technology is rapidly changing. We're doing a national trial in Minneapolis in the Uptown area at a technology called millimeter wave. So basically it's a multi-dwelling unit technology. We lease fiber, I believe it's from CenturyLink, into one building, and it's kind of the host building. We put Ethernet equipment into that apartment building or condo building, and then from there with an antenna on the roof, we can shoot gigabit speed wirelessly from one building to the next as far as we want to go, as long as we keep putting antennas that can receive that technology. That's another aspect. We're seeing gigabit plus speeds for whether it's in a millimeter wave, which is a real-time application now, or 14 gigabit with 5G in laboratory settings.
It's really, really cool, and it's really, this is just the beginning of it. Sort of the progress we've seen technologically with cellular communications. We sometimes make the mistake of thinking that we're on the mature side of it right now, and this is really just getting wound up and begun. So thank you for thank you, Representative O'Neill, for carrying the bill last year. I have no doubt that a lot of those investments in Minnesota wouldn't have taken place without Governor Dayton's signature and Representative O'Neill's work on that, as well as the Minnesota High Tech Association. And thank you for your decisions to make those. Oh, Representative Metza, Fabian, and Howe. I thought we were wrapped up, I guess. That's all. Representative Metza.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And just kind of along those lines, I think that, we've come a long way in the last year, and it's a good thing to get folks faster Internet connectivity through their phone. I just have a few connections about the current plans in place. So I've actually had a few neighbors who, with our local AT&T store in Mountain Iron, went and purchased the home bundle package. and have had to invest in repeaters and different things. We were told to get the app Mark the Spot, and we've been sending reports in through our neighborhood. We haven't heard anything back, and I know it takes time to do some upgrades and that there were actually some notifications for tower glitches as some repairs or something were getting done. But we've continually seen, actually, when I first got the phone, I was 3 to 4 bars all the time. And now when I'm at home, it's about 1 bar, and it fluctuates between 4G and LTE. When I go out to our cabin, I can actually download really fast stuff, better than any internet I can get in the area. And I think that's a good thing, but I'm kind of curious as to why our population centers would have those fluctuations. When we're making these investments, it would be nice to, you know, have the community be able to get service without drop calls and things, especially as they're trying to look at competitive bundling, internet service, home phone service, and their cell service. And I know just there have been issues, and I've gotten a call, and my neighborhood might be a weird pocket. AT&T is one of the stronger providers up on the range, and so I was just curious if there were plans to keep investments going in those areas.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Metz, I'd love to sit down with you separately and talk about the coverage problems there. One of the good things is we have the network. The folks that build it, design it, and construct it are headquartered here in Minneapolis for the five-state area. I've got folks that they kind of go out with tricorders, for lack of a better description, like Mr. Spock, and they can pinpoint it to the spot, you know, why there might be a degradation of the network, and we can talk about and. We will continue to invest. I know just on kind of the initial plans that I've seen, there's planned investment, but probably need to address the issue right now as to what's going on. We can do that.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. One quick follow-up. Yeah, I would be more than happy to sit down and do that, and do appreciate the Mark the Spot being out there. It would be nice if we could get a response from it every once in a while, because the whole neighborhood kind of signed up, and no one had received an email back. We, you know, got the notification that we did get in touch, but then there's no response. So, thank you.
Representative Fabian.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Wirtz, I'm curious on the FirstNet, and you talked about the 23 new towers. There's all kinds of towers all over the state of Minnesota. I was in Washington, D.C. for a conference on rural prosperity not too long ago. And one of the things that the Trump administration talked about at the thing that I was at was working with local providers to make federal towers available for cellular service. Have you had any conversations with either state or local governments or the federal government about sharing towers so that we don't have to develop that infrastructure from scratch?
Mr. Wirtz.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Fabian, we're in the kind of the site selection process for those towers, and obviously, with the state, for sure, if there's an opportunity where we might be able to put our equipment on a state tower, it's more about the tower equivalency of coverage, not so much the tower structure that we need to get at. One of the big things that we heard from the public safety community in Minnesota was coverage, that they wanted absolute the best coverage, and so we put this plan out there. That's not to say that AT&T's not in the tower business. We sold our interest in the actual tower. So this would be putting facilities either on a existing tower or leasing tower space. It could be DNR. It could be a number of those. So,
Representative Fabian.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Full disclosure, I'm not an AT&T customer, so just so you know. But when I'm in... we've had a lot of discussions about broadband and telecommunications, cellular networks. I'm not going to embarrass the group here, the room here, and ask you to raise your hand if you've ever been in eastern Kitson County, but I have been. And when I talk to the folks out there who are out there taking care of their cattle and they're tending their fences and they're harvesting their crops, this is more important to them on a daily basis than broadband service in their homes. Simply because this can provide a whole lot more for them in times of real critical need. So thank you for the expansion you're doing, and I applaud you. You guys even know where Baudette, Minnesota is. It's pretty cool. And Stephen, I like that. But I do have a couple of questions, if I may, Mr. Chair.
Representative Fabian.
Mr. Wirtz, how many Minnesotans work for AT&T?
Mr. Wirtz.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Fabian, we have more than 1,800 employees employed in the state of Minnesota. I can't tell you how many are native Minnesotans, but we have more than 1,800 employed in the state of Minnesota.
Thank you.
Representative Fabian.
Just give me a general idea. Are these good-paying jobs with good benefits?
Mr. Chairman, tell us what you make and what your benefits are. No, I'm just kidding.
As a 19-year veteran and proud employee of AT&T, I would say yes. I would also add that when you walk into an AT&T store, one of our employee-owned or employee stores, those are union jobs. We have individuals that have come from the AT&T store that are now managing and directing hundreds of millions of dollars in network investment. So there are some great Minnesota-grown stories right here in Minnesota with our workforce.
Thank you. And
Representative Fabian.
Mr. Wirtz, when AT&T makes a profit, what do you do with your profits?
Mr. Wirtz.
Mr. Chairman, I hope my CFO is not anywhere around. So we plow that back in terms of capital investment. And I mentioned the $25 billion that we're going to invest in America's economy. Obviously, a return to shareholders. We put that in the pockets of employees. We pay for college educations. We pay for braces on children's teeth. We pay good health care benefits. All of that goes into the big mix that's AT&T.
Thank you. Keep up the good work.
Thank you.
Representative Howe, and then O'Neill.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And, sir, I just looked at these list of 299 communities where, enhancements have been made, and I see all the communities in my district are on that list. So my question is there a way I can identify whether you put up a new tower, whether you added additional equipment onto these towers? How do I find out exactly what these enhancements are in my district?
That's sure.
So, Mr. Chairman, Representative, we can get you that by your district in terms of everything we've done. Yeah, that was really in just for the purposes of expediency to kind of give you a list of the communities where we invest, but we can give you the more detail of everything we did in your district.
Representative Howe.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And I've got a selfish reason. Somebody's put a tower right across the road. I'm trying to figure out who did it. If it gives me better service, I'm switching. So.
Representative O'Neill, you get the last one.
Okay, great. Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Wirtz, I appreciate working with you. We had a great time. And in so doing, I had an informational sheet. And the reason I waited till the end is I was hoping you were going to tell us the good news that I found in that sheet that you'd given me a ways back. And that was, I don't remember if it was 7 years or 10 years of the looking ahead. But what do you suppose is the private sector investment? And I think it was collectively of the four major cell providers, and then the corresponding GDP growth. Do you happen to have those numbers with you today?
Representative O'Neill, I should have that, considering that was rolling off the tip of my tongue last year, but I am remiss. But I do recall it was an Accenture study, and I don't want to be inaccurate, but we could get that. But it's in the billions, the job creation. Just for example, I guess by point of reference, with the recent tax plan that was passed by Congress, we committed to, we're at $24 billion, and then we committed an extra billion. And from my understanding, the extra calculation, for every billion you spend, that's about 7,000 new jobs created in America's economy. So there is kind of that we will see. But I can get you a more accurate response. Just forgot it, unfortunately.
Okay. Thank you.
Well, thank you. And again, it's very rare that we can have a policy and then have a short-term turnaround with the confluence of this bill passing and the technological upgrades that are available and then the big game happening in February. It was pretty cool. So thank you again for what you did, and thanks for testifying today.
Thank you.
Next, Representative Dabney and Exodus Lending.
Yes, Mr. Chair.
And so, Representative Dabney, I know this is kind of a unique provision. Remember, this may be, this is in last year's omnibus bill, but I believe you have a testifier, and if you want to...
I do, and maybe two. Do you want me seated there, seated here, Mr. Chairman?
It's up to you, Representative Dabney.
Why don't we...
Representative Dabney.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And, Mr. Chair, as you just indicated, last year included in the omnibus bill was a provision that I had authored for $100,000 to support the work of Exodus Lending. Exodus Lending is a nonprofit headquartered in my district, but that works in 18 different counties across the state and is looking to continue to expand the area of their work. They work in the area of the payday lending challenge that many working-class Minnesotans face, needing $500 to get the car fixed and needing it now, and going to a payday lender but then having difficulty in 2 weeks paying off that payday loan. With me today is Sarah Nelson-Pallmeyer. She's the executive director of Exodus Lending, and she can review with you their work over the last year and their future hopes.
Yeah.
Welcome to the committee. Please state your name for the record and proceed to the testimony.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and committee members. My name is Sarah Nelson-Pallmeyer, and I'm the executive director of Exodus Lending, as Representative Dabney said. Exodus Lending is a nonprofit organization started out of a church in South Minneapolis that's now working statewide to help people get free from payday loan debt. And I'm grateful for this invitation to come here today to thank you for the funding that you provided last year to Exodus Lending to help carry out our important work. And I invite you to look at the handout that you got about Exodus Lending that should be in your packet. So payday loans are small dollar loans, usually about $250 to $1,000 that people take out in an emergency typically. And they have extremely high interest rates in the hundreds of percentage APR. But unlike a typical loan, payday loans have to be paid back in full. There's no partial payment accepted. They have to be paid back in full on a borrower's next payday. And what happens is typically borrowers can't pay that back in full because they needed the money 2 weeks ago. They still needed the money today. And so what they end up doing is going back to the payday lender numerous times to re-up their loan, and then all they pay is fees and interest. And so they can't get out of that payday loan trap. And that's what it's called. Just it feels like a trap to people. So we don't have data yet for 2017, but in 2016, nearly 49,000 Minnesotans took out 400,000 plus payday loans in our state. And borrowers averaged about 9 loans each, with 59% of borrowers taking out at least 5 loans and 10% taking out over 20 loans in 1 year time. So Minnesotans for Fair Lending estimates that $110 million in interest and fees were drained from Minnesota between 1999 and 2014, and $10 million in interest and fees last in 2016 alone. Now, this is money that should be used for groceries, for rent, for a mortgage if one has one, for gasoline to get to work, for all sorts of other things, and it's not. It's just being used over and over for fees and interest. So interestingly, in 2016, there were 50 storefront payday lenders active in Minnesota in 20 counties throughout the state. So they're not in every county, but 20 counties in Minnesota have them. But additionally, there were 5 online lenders, and they lend to anyone throughout the state. And they have to report their information to the Department of Commerce, which is how we've been able to learn about what happened. And the counties, as it says there, with a that we've calculated to have the highest payday per capita use of payday loans are Clay up at Moorhead area, Anoka, Blue Earth, Olmsted, Hennepin, Ramsey, Dakota, Stearns, Hubbard, and St. Louis. So these are the areas of the state that we are trying to target, that's what we're doing right now. So we have a limited amount of information about people who have taken out, about these 40,000 plus who have taken out payday loans. But what we do know is about the people who have come to us to try to get out of the payday loan trap since we opened in 2015. And these are adults of all ages. They're white, they're black, they're Native American, they're Latino, they're new immigrants, they're people who have lived in Minnesota their whole lives. And the vast majority are employed, although you can get a payday loan if you have a steady income that's fixed. As long as you have a steady income, you can get a payday loan. Several of the people who've worked with us are veterans, and they're struggling too. All the people who come to us, though, are in crisis, every single one of them. And they hear about us from a friend or their pastor or a report in the news, or, you know, some from former participants who've had their struggles and have been freed from their payday loans by us. And also people find us online. And I just want to share a little email that came last week from a person who wrote to us, who found us online, and this is what he said. This is a quote. "I have 3 payday loans out, and I just cannot seem to get out of this payday loan debt nightmare, which I have to take all 3 of them out over and over and over again and again and again. I am at my wit's end and desperately need help. It is so incredibly depressing and humiliating to ask for help. Please, can you help me get out of this nightmare? Sincerely, Scott." Well, for people like Scott, here's what Exodus Lending does. In fact, we're doing it with Scott on Saturday. He's coming to our office on Saturday. We take Scott's paperwork from his payday lender, and Scott signs a promissory note to Exodus Lending that he will pay us back the exact amount of the debt that he owes the payday lender. And so what we do is we go to the payday lender, and we go to that store, and we pay off the loan, whatever that amount is. And then we take that amount, we divide it by 12, and Scott pays us back once a month for 12 months and pays and is done. Notice that the amount does not change. No interest is added. No fees are added. Loan payments are then recycled to new people who come. New people like Scott is benefiting by the people who had loans a year ago who have paid them back. So we also encourage our program participants to meet with a financial counselor, such as someone from a referral agency like LSS Financial or Prepare and Prosper, and a county. Sometimes counties, especially Dakota County, does a really good job of doing financial counseling. So we encourage them to meet with a financial counselor, and we actually offer a financial incentive to do so, $50 per visit with a financial counselor. And we additionally offer a financial incentive to those folks who work to start a savings account and add to their savings account. So for every $100 they save, we will match 25% of that, up to them saving $400, and we will put $100 back into their account. So on page 2 of your handout, you can see some of the results of our work. We've had 76 who've had paid in full, 76 who are current, and you can read the numbers there. I just want to point out a couple that we've refinanced $106,000+ for those 152 individuals. And if those people would be paying their loans to the payday lender over 12 months, they would have spent nearly $400,000. So that's $400,000 that we have saved individuals here in our community. To date, we've got 18 counties represented, and the average of the loans that people have taken out with the payday lenders was 368% APR. So we're saving them a lot of money. If you have other questions about the stats there, just let me know. We're using the funds that we got from the state to expand our work to the areas of most concern. Tomorrow, for example, I am getting up bright and early. I'm giving a talk to an optimist group in Bloomington at 7:30, and then I'm hopping in the car and driving up to Moorhead, where I have appointments scheduled with faith communities, social service agencies, CAP agencies, students, some people running for office, and others to show what we can do to help those folks get out of the payday loan trap. Because although Clay County is one of the highest areas, is the highest area per capita in the state of payday loan use, we don't have any participants from that area. So we want to take advantage of this funding to help go to the areas like Clay County, like Moorhead, to try to let folks know. Mr. Chair and committee members, I had really hoped to bring along a participant of ours to speak about their experience with us, and several indicated they really wanted to, but it was hard for them to get out of their work day today to do so. They said, please share my story. Would you share my story? So I'm going to end with a story from Deb, a woman who has been in our program for about 5 months, and these, again, are her words. "I was desperate for money after racking up medical bills and accumulating credit card debt, so I turned to a payday loan. The relief the loan brought was quick and very short term, but that quickly changed. Soon I was paying about 60% of my salary, or $500 a month in interest and fees, exclusively to payday loans. I kept asking myself, why did I do this? Why did I do this? I felt stressed, anxious, and hopeless. I was in so deep, I couldn't see out. Eventually, I was so overwhelmed, I shared my financial struggles with my closest friends. With their encouragement, I enrolled in Exodus Lending. Since Exodus Lending paid off my payday loan, I've had paychecks where I wasn't in the hole already. It's quite enlightening. It's giving me hope, and it has lifted a great deal off of my shoulders. I can now make choices, whereas before it was taken out of my hands. I am taking steps to prepare myself for future unexpected medical unexpected expenses by building up my personal savings. Now, if somewhere down the road I do run into medical expenses, I have a resource. Up until now, I had not. After refinancing with Exodus Lending, I feel empowered. It has helped my self-esteem. I'm taking responsibility, and I'm taking steps to move forward. I didn't see a light at the end of the tunnel, and now I do. I smile a little more. I'm a little happier. I walk with a lighter step. I hold my head up a little higher. Every day is a brighter day. I'm in a much better place because of the help I received from Exodus Lending. I'm very appreciative and grateful. So Deb's story is just one that I could share, and I want to thank you again for the support from the state of Minnesota for our work. But and finally, if any of you have a nonprofit or faith community or governmental agency in your district that works with persons trapped by payday loans, please pass along my contact information, which is on the front of your handout, and I'd be happy to connect with them and tell them about the services we provide. I did meet, by the way, last week with Representative Lean from Moorhead. I almost said Fargo. That would be bad.
No.
From Moorhead, and he is very excited that I'm going up there tomorrow and meeting with folks there. So it was fun to meet with him, and I'd be more than happy to meet with any of you. So thank you, Mr. Chairman and representatives of the committee, and I'd be happy to answer any questions you might have.
Representative Dabney, any closing comments before we go to member questions and comments?
No, Mr. Chair. I just point out a couple of things on the backside of the handout that Ms. Nelson-Pallmeyer provided. 90%, above 90% repayment rate that Exodus Lending experiences with their clients. These folks are actually a very good credit risk, and the payday lending industry has testified before legislative committees in the past that they have a 2% default rate. I would imagine U.S. Bank and Wells Fargo would love a 2% default rate on the loans that they provide to prime credit candidates. And then lastly, the $37,500 median income of the payday, of the Exodus Lending clients contrasts with the $58,476 median family income of the average Minnesotan, or excuse me, median income of the average Minnesotan. So these are lower income working Minnesotans who are taking advantage of getting out of a cycle that frees up a lot of their income to be used in better places, as well as a lot of their emotional space.
I want to compliment you, Representative Dabney. I know this was not a bill that we had heard in committee, nor did the Senate, but you were very persistent with the conferees and were providing a lot of information to make sure that people had access to the information about the benefits that a one-time grant of expanding the capacity building the organization could make. So I just want to compliment you on that, that you were, your persistence in making this app become law. So you worked the conferees very hard.
Well, Mr. Chair, I need to thank you because, needless to say, when you're the chair, your support was critical, and we were able to have some, I think, blunt but and honest conversations. But your support for this was critical, and I appreciate that very much.
Yep. Representative Makewade.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank you, Ms. Nelson-Pallmeyer, for being here. I met a woman last year who got trapped in this predatory lending cycle because she needed new glasses. And one of the things I want to know, in addition to supporting the expansion of this with a one-time grant, what are some other things that we can do as a legislative body to help people not get into it in the first place, or make sure that there's some protections around this predatory payday lending?
Ms. Nelson-Pallmeyer.
Yes, Mr. Chair and Representative McQuaid, thank you for the question. There are many things that you can do. First of all, talk about it. Talk about it with your constituents and let them know that this is not something that they, most of them often feel shame, and they think they did something stupid, and they just thought they were trying to pay a bill and didn't realize that they would get so trapped. In fact, I highly encourage you, if you any of you have Netflix, to watch. There's a new series called Dirty Money, and episode 2 is all about payday lending. And it's a fascinating explanation of how people get caught up and think they're making payments when they're really not. And so it's a cycle that they can't get out of. So I would say to talk about it, and it's not a shameful thing. Bring that up to people. And again, if you have folks in your if you're connected to churches or other groups, I've gone out to I've gone out to Apple Valley, I've gone other places and given presentations about our work, so that people, in fact, when people call and they say, so you're telling me that I should get a loan and a payday loan and then come to you to take care of it? Like, no. Don't misunderstand me. I'm saying do anything else. Borrow money from a friend, get extra hours at work, beg to your parents again, or do whatever it is that you can do to avoid the payday loan trap, first of all. Now, as a legislative body, there are plenty of things you can do. I don't know if you want to talk about any of, like, interest rates?
Probably not in this committee.
Probably not in this committee.
Yeah. So I think there are other committees, other things that can be done, primarily this group is helping us do the outreach and get out as much as we can.
And, of course, financial literacy is always helpful. It sounds like that's a component of your when you're working with clients, is you're helping educate them on financial literacy.
Right. Thank you for asking about that. So we do strongly encourage financial literacy. Well, that's important, but also financial counseling. And we don't require it. Sometimes people think we should require it, but then people can't get the money they need right away to pay off their payday loan. So we work with them right away. And then we strongly encourage and we financially incentivize it.
And the high repayment rate is, it's a very high repayment rate. That's good work. So I want to be very clear in case, because sometimes members hear the information they want to hear. The state's appropriation was not to the revolving loan fund that you guys set up. It was for capacity building. So you're able to reach out, and in case people are thinking that we're funding revolving loan programs in the nonprofits. Any other questions or comments from members of the committee? Any closing comments, Representative Dabney?
Thank you very much, Mr. Chair. I appreciate the opportunity to bring Exodus Lending before the committee, and thank you again for your support last year.
Thank you. Thank you. Last item on the agenda is the Ramsey Washington Recycling and Energy Center.
No clue.
Never mind. Okay, so members, that's okay. So this is a provision that Representative Mahoney was successful in getting in last year's bill that was signed into law, and Representative Mahoney's not here today, so we could certainly have I appreciate Representative Metz's offer to present the facts of it without knowing any of the facts of it whatsoever, but I think we'll go with the testifiers here, if that's okay. Representative Metz, unless...
Mr. Chair, I've learned a lot on this committee over the years.
I can only imagine. Okay, so welcome to the committee. Please state your name for the record. And again, if you could tell a little bit of the background of your facility, kind of act as the presenters for it, and then if you want us to, we can cover what was in last year's bill for you. But welcome to the committee. Please state your names for the record.
Thank you. My name is Victoria Reinhardt. I'm a Ramsey County Commissioner, and I am chair of the Ramsey Washington Recycling and Energy Board. And with me I have?
Fran Muron, Washington County Commissioner and Vice Chair of the Recycling and Energy Board.
Welcome to the committee.
Thank you. And we also have staff here. Zach Hansen is the Environmental Health Director from Ramsey County, and Judy Hunter is the Senior Environmental Resource Manager from Washington County, in case you have questions that we need to consult with them on. And I really want to thank you for the opportunity to appear before the committee and explain how the Recycling and Energy Board plans to invest the funds provided by the legislature so generously in 2017. I believe that you have a copy of the PowerPoint handout, and that's we'll be trying to stick to that as much as possible. We have a couple of other handouts as well about the actual projects. So I will give you kind of the background on this. As Commissioner Mirren has pointed out many times, I'm the one that has the history with this since when it was formed, the partnership being formed in the 1980s. I was actually working for a county commissioner at that point, and so was there for the groundbreaking of this facility, which was a privately owned facility. And we have, you know, it's been around, again, since the 1980s, which tells you how long I've been in garbage. So, but I find it very empowering, to be quite honest with you, because when it comes to the environment, when it comes to the economy and how many jobs and so forth that there are, it really comes down to the individual's choice and what they can do to help with that. So we have been in partnership, Ramsey and Washington County, since the 1980s. There are 9 commissioners from the 2 counties that were on the original board, and we do joint waste and recycling activities. So this facility was part of our solid waste management and recycling activities. It is aligned with the solid waste master plans, and at that time, again, the operation was a privately owned facility, and at this point it is owned and operated by the Recycling and Energy Center, governed by this board, the Recycling and Energy Board. So with an eye to the future, really, when this was first looked at as far as what we would do, the private sector, and Commissioner Mirren will get into more of the economics of everything that happened, but the private sector that was running this facility said, we don't want to do it anymore. And so we had all of this investment, and we wanted to make sure that we were doing the right thing for the environment, saving jobs. And, again, Commissioner Mirren will get more into that. But we looked at the future, and we said, you know what, with the 75% recycling goal, we need to do something different. And we purchased the facility so that we could move waste up the hierarchy and really get things done. And I will let him go into more detail with that. So we really are looking at even more joint efforts in the future. So, again, the Recycling and Energy Center was built in 1987 and has really been maintained and continuously operating effectively. It is the, and actually I didn't know this until I got the talking points here, it's the largest facility of its kind in the United States, processing 450,000 tons per year of trash and receiving an average of about 1,500 tons per day. It produces fuel used to generate electricity. It's called refuse-derived fuel, or RDF, and it recovers metals from the materials that come in each year that are recycled. Of the waste processed, on the average, the amount of RDF produced is 80%, and the metals are about 10%. The other 10% is landfilled, which means it's a 90% diversion from landfills. Again, in deciding to purchase this facility, we made it clear that process improvements would be made to increase the recovery of recyclables and work to develop alternative markets for the fuel. Following the purchase, the counties have already invested $5.7 million of local funds to meet capital needs at the center. These improvements are the first step in the improvements, and I want to turn it over to Commissioner Mirren at this point.
I'm going to move over to slide 6 or page 6 on your handout, which gets us to the project that we use the state funds. We're relocating and replacing an area called the Bulky Waste Residue Loadout Area. After haulers drop trash onto our tipping floor, the first step in processing is to separate the waste that cannot be handled in the processing lines. This material is called bulky waste residue. The type of waste cannot be processed because it may be too large, it may be too long, stringy, and it fouls the processing equipment, or it may be dusty and create a risk of explosion within the facility. Some of the bulky waste residue can be reprocessed by placing it into a shredder to make it the proper size. Bulky waste residue that cannot be pre-processed is transferred into trailers and delivered to another facility. The current loadout area was built in 1986. It's complicated and it's expensive to maintain. The replacement of the current bulky waste residue loadout area includes removing and recycling the old equipment, installing a back-end ramp for transfer trailers, and an enclosed loadout area. A building addition will be added in the vacated space for equipment installation and recyclable storage. This design will not require as much equipment and will need less maintenance. We plan to add state-of-the-art technology equipment to further process trash and replacing the bulky waste residue loadout area along with repurposing adjacent space will provide the needed enclosed area required. The bulky waste residue loadout area replacement and storage space redesign will result in an estimated annual operating savings of $160,000 per year, $30,000 in maintenance costs, and $130,000 in reduced transportation costs. We certainly welcome, and on page 7 of your handout is an overview of the processing plant that we own. The map shows the location of the bulky waste residue loadout project, and we certainly would welcome the committee for a tour at any point in time. And quite frankly, we do tours on a regular basis there for school children, people interested in how their waste is handled here in Washington and Ramsey County, and those interested in environmental stewardship.
I thought for a second there that perhaps you brought the kids there as a form of punishment or something. Out of the town. So please proceed to the testimony.
Thank you. With respect to the financial, this project is the first phase of the Recycling and Energy Center improvements to add new technology. It's funded primarily by Ramsey and Washington counties with use of funds granted by the legislature in 2017. We want to thank you for that. The ratio of local to state funding on this particular project is 4.5 to 1. So we're proud of the fact that we're matching dollars at that rate and making good investments here in the facility that handles all the waste from here. So we appreciate that as well. Recycling and Energy Board will be issuing a request for bids in May of 2018 with construction expected to begin in July and completion expected in November. And with that, we thank you for the opportunity to come before you, explain to you how we're using that allocation of funds, and we're happy to stand for questions that you may have.
Thank you. Any questions or comments from members of the committee? Representative Anderson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Nice presentation. Just wondering about the tipping fees and if the haulers in your counties contractually have to haul waste to your facility.
To either of the testifiers?
The haulers do have to pay to the county, and the current rate is $77 per ton. With the purchase of the facility, we were able to do designation of waste, which has started this year, which means from Ramsey and Washington counties, the waste that is generated in Ramsey and Washington counties does have to come to this facility, and that brings us up to capacity at that facility. So 450,000 tons between the two counties.
Any other questions or comments from members of the committee? And again, Representative O'Neill. Representative Fabian.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. To either of the testifiers on the $77 tipping fee, what is the market rate at other facilities in the area then for tipping fees?
Those testifiers.
Mr. Chair, Representative Fabian, when we took over this facility in 2015, our cost was $86 a ton to the private sector. We've reduced that cost to $77 a ton now. We do, and as Commissioner Reinhart mentioned, we are operating at capacity since we assigned waste designation here as the first of the year. And that was one of the real reasons that we acquired this facility. Two reasons, actually. One was the private sector said they were going out of business, they were going to put it on the market, and we had a purchase agreement with them throughout our operating time. And the second was to add additional technology to potentially reduce fees there. But we've reduced that to $77 a ton. We've got waste designation. We're acting at full capacity. So whatever we don't have capacity to manage at this facility goes to Elk River, and we're currently paying $94 a ton to the Elk River there to handle that material, along with our that's our transportation costs and our unloading costs there.
Representative Fabian.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And that's included in that. The transportation and the handling is all included
correct
in that. 77 at your facility, and then the 94, did you say?
94, we've got extra transportation costs. We've got a tipping cost there, so that adds to $94 a ton.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And just for a point of reference, what are the tipping fees at other at just the regular landfills that process trash in a different way that you do?
Mr. Chair, Representative, we're not hauling anything to the landfill other than the 10% that was discussed earlier, and quite frankly, I'm not sure what that cost is.
That's what I was wondering about. Okay.
But we can get that information to you.
Representative O'Neill.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Maybe you had said this, but what's the nameplate capacity of the generation of energy? How many megawatts are you producing from the refuse?
Actually, Mr. Chair, if I may, and Representative O'Neill, we do not produce energy at the facility. So all of this material, the RDF that Commissioner Reinhart talked about, is hauled to Xcel Energy, and it's burned there.
Which plant for Xcel? They have several.
Pardon me?
Which facility are you going to?
We're going to two different facilities. One is in southwest Minnesota, and we actually do some haul back there.
And
thank you.
I'm guessing district energy, too, right?
Pardon me?
Never mind. No? Okay, forget it. Representative O'Neill?
Yeah, that was where I was assuming, too, but must not be in St. Paul or Minneapolis. Or.
Mr. Chair, Representative, we'll get you that information as well.
And again, if you could provide it to the staff, and then we'll share with everyone so we get the answers. Any other questions or comments from members of the committee? Thank you very much for your presentation. We appreciate it.
Thank you.
Members, just a couple of committee announcements. First of all, I've had our nonpartisan staff supply last year's end of session spreadsheet in your folder. Probably a good idea to put that in your save folder so you can reference where budget items are at right now. For members of the committee and members of the public, obviously we have an abbreviated schedule for this legislative session. If there are ways that the government is getting in the way of blocking you from doing things, if the government is requiring you to spend money on non-value-added activities, please get those ideas in, get that legislation submitted, and we'll take a look at it. Reminder for everyone that tomorrow is the budget forecast, so we'll have that information. I don't expect we'll be doing a review of it in tomorrow's committee, but at some point, if and when we see a supplemental budget from the governor, we'll likely review the forecast as well as any supplemental appropriations from the governor's office. But again, just a reminder to members of the committee that we're on a much more abbreviated schedule. So if you do have policy considerations or appropriations that you would like to see met, please do get those bills drafted and get those submitted earlier. Things are going to happen a lot quicker than we anticipate. Keep in mind, we're 2 days away from March. So any questions or comments from the committee? Seeing none, we're